A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been down a rabbit hole of fringe belief systems, and he wants the 10 most weirdly specific cults in history. Not just any cults, the ones where the whole thing hangs on one incredibly narrow idea. A particular prophecy, a single object, a diet, a location, a bizarre explanation of the universe. He wants to know what they believed, how they started, how people organized their lives around it, and where the line is between harmless eccentric and genuinely dangerous. So we dug through history's strangest corners. Here's what we found.
The criterion is the interesting part here. We're not talking about broad religious movements or even standard doomsday cults. We're looking for the groups where you hear the central belief and think, that's the whole thing? That one idea anchors everything?
Right. A mountain that charges spiritual energy. A comet with a spaceship behind it. A diet of light. The belief is so specific you could fit it on a post-it note, but people built entire lives around it.
And the question underneath is how that happens. How does one extremely particular idea become a full worldview that organizes someone's identity, their relationships, their daily rituals? And when does that turn from odd to dangerous?
Let's start with the ones that are more strange than sinister. The groups where you read about them and think, well, that's weird, but nobody got hurt.
The Aetherius Society. Founded in the 1950s by a British man named George King. King was a cab driver and a yoga practitioner who claimed he received a telepathic message from a cosmic master from Venus named Aetherius.
Name the society after his pen pal.
Basically. King taught that spiritual energy could be physically stored in mountains. Mountains function as terrestrial batteries for cosmic prayer energy.
So you go to a mountain and charge it?
You perform what they call Operation Prayer Power. Followers gather at designated holy mountains. There are 19 of them worldwide, and direct spiritual energy into the mountain through focused meditation. The mountain holds the charge, and when enough energy has been stored, it radiates out to help humanity.
I love the specificity. Not just prayer helps the world. Prayer is stored in a mountain like a battery, and you have to physically go there to top it off.
And they did. Still do, actually. The group is active. They make pilgrimages to these mountains, hold services, publish a magazine. King wrote dozens of books channeling wisdom from the cosmic masters. They believe in reincarnation, karma, the usual New Age framework, but the mountain battery thing is the centerpiece. It's what you do.
The mechanism is what fascinates me. A narrow belief like that creates instant in-group identity. You know things the rest of the world doesn't know. You've been to the mountain. You've participated in charging it. That shared experience binds you to the group.
And it's active. It's not just a thing you believe, it's a thing you do. You get on a bus, you go to the mountain, you meditate for hours. That ritual creates commitment. The more you invest, the harder it's to walk away.
Harmless, though.
Completely. Nobody's being isolated or exploited. It's a quirky spiritual practice with a very elaborate science fiction backstory.
Speaking of clubs with backstories, the Church of Euthanasia.
This one's a lot. Founded in 1992 by Reverend Chris Korda in Boston. The central belief is that humanity must voluntarily reduce its population to save the planet. One solution to one problem taken to its logical extreme.
Their slogan was, save the planet, kill yourself.
They had four pillars, suicide, abortion, cannibalism, and sodomy. Any sexual act that doesn't lead to procreation was a sacrament. Their reasoning, overpopulation, is the root of all environmental problems, so the only ethical act is to stop reproducing and ideally stop living.
The cannibalism part
was mostly metaphorical, as far as anyone can tell. They said eating the dead was more ethical than burying them because it reduces waste. I don't think there's evidence they actually did it. Korda was a musician and artist, and the whole thing had a confrontational performance art quality.
So, was it a real religion or an art project that got out of hand?
I think that's a false distinction with a lot of these groups. It started as provocation, but people took it seriously. The specificity here is almost mathematical. One variable, one solution. No nuance, no middle ground.
That's the pattern. The narrower the belief, the more totalizing it becomes. If you accept the premise, the conclusion is inescapable. The Church of Euthanasia never really crossed the line into violence. It was mostly online, mostly rhetorical. More of a thought experiment that some people took as a calling.
Let's talk about the Birtharians. The core belief is that humans can live without food or water sustained entirely by prana, life energy, basically light. The founder, Wiley Brooks, claimed he'd gone years without eating and ran workshops teaching people to survive on air and sunlight.
And then someone caught him at a convenience store.
Multiple times. In 1983, a reporter spotted him leaving a 7-Eleven with groceries. He claimed the food was for emotional comfort, not nutrition. Later, he was seen at a buffet. His explanation was that he occasionally ate to stay grounded, or because the air quality was bad.
The air quality defense. I'm going to remember that.
But people still followed him. He charged hundreds of dollars for workshops. Some followers attempted to stop eating. A few died. A woman in Scotland starved to death in 1999, a Swiss woman in 2012.
So this one crosses the line.
It does. The belief is specific, you can live on light, and the practice is straightforward, stop eating. But the practice kills you. The specificity makes it testable, and the test fails every time, and people still believed. The leader has to explain away the failures, and the followers have to rationalize their own suffering.
The sunk cost of not eating for a week makes it harder to admit you were wrong than to just keep not eating.
And Brooks was actively deceptive. He ate in secret while telling others not to. That's not sincere belief. That's exploitation.
The Order of the Solar Temple. This one gets darker.
Much darker. Started in the 1980s by Joseph Dimambro and Luc Jure. Jure was a charismatic Belgian doctor. Dimambro was the behind-the-scenes organizer. They blended Knights Templar mythology, New Age channeling, and apocalyptic Christianity into one very specific belief. Members were reincarnated souls from the original Knights Templar who would ascend to a new realm orbiting the star Sirius.
Sirius is the detail.
That's the post-it note. Not heaven, not paradise, Sirius. A specific star, 8.6 light years away. They believed a planetary catastrophe was coming, and the Chosen would transcend their physical bodies and be transported to a new world around Sirius.
And they didn't wait for the transport.
No. In 1994, 53 members died in mass suicides and murders in Switzerland and Canada. In 1995, 16 more in France. In 1997, 5 more in Quebec. Altogether, 74 people died.
The mechanism here is important. They didn't just believe in Sirius. They believed they were special souls, and Dimambro controlled who was worthy. He could demote you, declare you a traitor. The specificity of the star gave the whole thing a destination, a timeline, a concrete payoff.
And Dimambro used it to extract money, loyalty, and ultimately lives. Members signed over their assets, cut off family, moved to isolated compounds. All the classic control mechanisms. But the engine was this one image, a new life on a planet around Sirius.
Let's round out the first five with the Raelians.
Founded by Claude Vorilhon, who now goes by Rael, in 1974. He was a French racing journalist who claimed he was contacted by an alien being named Yahweh. Yes, that Yahweh. The alien told him that all life on Earth was created by an advanced extraterrestrial civilization called the Elohim using DNA synthesis.
So, the specificity is that humans are a biotech project.
A lab experiment. The Elohim engineered us, and all human religion is a misunderstanding of these alien encounters. Jesus, Buddha, Moses, all prophets sit by the Elohim. Rael is the latest and last.
And they got into cloning.
In 2002, a Raelian-affiliated company called Clonaid announced they produced the first human clone, a baby named Eve. They never produced the baby or any evidence. The whole thing collapsed under media scrutiny, but for a few weeks, it was a global story.
The belief is very specific. Aliens made us with DNA, and cloning is the sacred technology that brings us closer to them. They're not violent, not coercive in the classic sense, but they built an entire institutional structure around one very strange claim.
So across these five, we've got a spectrum. The Aetherius Society, harmless mountain charging. The Church of Euthanasia, provocative but mostly rhetorical. The Breatharians, harmful through negligence and fraud. The Solar Temple, deadly mass suicide. The Raelians, institutionalized weirdness with no bodies.
And in every case, the specificity is what makes it work. A mountain battery, a star destination, an alien named Yahweh with a DNA lab. These are vague spiritual feelings. They're concrete claims you can organize around, perform rituals for, and defend against skeptics.
The narrowness is the strength. A broad philosophy can be interpreted 100 ways. A comet with a spaceship behind it only has one.
Which brings us to the second half. The ones where the specificity didn't just organize lives, it ended them.
The Manson family. Charles Manson was a failed musician who spent most of his life in and out of prison. By the late 1960s, he'd gathered a group of mostly young women around him in California. He had a prophecy, a very specific one.
A race war.
He called it Helter Skelter, after the Beatles song. Manson believed the song was a coded message to him personally. The prophecy, black Americans would rise up and slaughter white America in an apocalyptic race war. Manson and his family would hide in a secret underground city in Death Valley during the chaos. After the war, the black population would realize they couldn't govern themselves and would turn to Manson as their leader.
That's the specific part. Not just a race war that ends with Charles Manson in charge.
And he believed the war needed to be triggered. In August 1969, he sent followers to murder 7 people, including Sharon Tate, and tried to frame the Black Panthers. He didn't just predict violence, he manufactured it to fulfill his own prophecy.
The closed logic is terrifying. Any evidence against the prophecy is just part of the prophecy. The war hasn't started yet because we haven't done enough to trigger it. Everything confirms the belief.
And the followers were isolated, drugged, sexually exploited, and psychologically broken down. The Helter Skelter prophecy gave them a narrative that made sense of their suffering and justified anything they were asked to do.
Heaven's Gate. The Comet Cult.
Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Nettles met in 1972. They believed they were the 2 witnesses from the Book of Revelation and eventually landed on a very specific exit strategy.
They called their bodies containers.
Vehicles. Temporary housing for the soul. They taught that Earth was about to be recycled, and the only way to survive was to leave your container behind and ascend to a spacecraft hidden behind the Hale-Bopp comet. The comet was visible in 1997, and that was the deadline. In March of that year, 39 members committed suicide in a mansion in Rancho Santa Fe, California. They did it in shifts over 3 days, wearing matching black shirts and sweatpants, each with a $5 bill and 3/4 in their pocket, for the interplanetary toll.
The specificity is almost absurd. Matching outfits, pocket change, a comet with a spaceship behind it. And yet, 39 people were so convinced they drank phenobarbital mixed with vodka and put plastic bags over their heads.
And they weren't isolated loners. Several were web designers running a successful business. Intelligent, functional people who had slowly accepted a worldview where suicide was the logical next step.
The comet gave them a deadline. If the belief were vague, someday we'll ascend. You could put it off forever. But Hale-Bopp is here now. The window is closing. You have to act.
Aum Shinrikyo. The Tokyo subway attack.
This one's different because the violence was outward.
Shoko Asahara founded Aum Shinrikyo in 1984, blending Buddhism, Hinduism, and Christian apocalypticism into a specific prophecy. A world war would destroy civilization, and only Aum members would survive.
And they decided to help the prophecy along.
Asahara predicted the United States would attack Japan and trigger World War III, setting a date of 1997. By 1997, the prophecy wasn't materializing fast enough, and the group was facing legal pressure. So they acted.
Sarin gas in the Tokyo subway.
March 20th, 1995. 5 members released liquid sarin on 3 subway lines during rush hour. 13 people died. Thousands were injured. The most deadly terrorist attack in Japan since World War II. They had laboratories, manufactured sarin and VX nerve gas, attempted to acquire a helicopter for aerial dispersal. Tens of thousands of members, billions of yen in assets, and a leader who claimed his bathwater had healing powers.
The specificity used the prophecy as justification for preemptive violence. The world war is coming, so anything we do to prepare or trigger, it's righteous. Asahara was executed in 2018 along with 12 other senior members.
The People's Temple, Jonestown.
Jim Jones started the People's Temple in Indianapolis in the 1950s. He preached racial equality and apostolic socialism. Good things. He was a civil rights activist, integrated churches, adopted children of different races.
And then it went somewhere very dark. Jones gradually shifted from preacher to prophet to self-proclaimed God, the reincarnation of Jesus, Lenin, and Buddha. He moved the group to California, then to Guyana, where he established Jonestown.
The specific belief that drove the final act?
Jones became convinced the U.S. government was conspiring to destroy him and take the children. He ran drills called White Nights, where members drank what they were told was poison as a test of loyalty. In November 1978, after a visiting congressman was shot dead at the airstrip, Jones told everyone it was over. The conspiracy was real. They had to take control of their own deaths.
918 people.
The largest single loss of American civilian life in a deliberate act until September 11th. Children first, mothers squirted cyanide-laced Flavor Aid into their babies' mouths. Then the adults drank. Jones died of a gunshot wound to the head, likely self-inflicted.
The conspiracy theory was the engine, not a prophecy about the future, a belief about the present. They're coming for us. They're already on their way. The specificity of the threat made resistance feel urgent and death feel like the only option.
And Jones had spent years building toward that moment. Isolation, sleep deprivation, constant surveillance, public humiliations. By the time he gave the order, the group had no capacity to resist.
The Branch Davidians. Waco.
David Koresh joined the Branch Davidians, a splinter from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and eventually took control. His specific belief, he was the Lamb of God from the Book of Revelation, with a unique ability to interpret the seven seals.
The seven seals are the post-it note here.
Revelation describes a scroll sealed with seven seals that only the Lamb can open. Koresh taught that he alone understood the seals and that they predicted an imminent end times confrontation. He stockpiled hundreds of weapons, including illegal machine guns, and told followers to be ready to fight.
And the confrontation came.
February 28, 1993. The ATF raided the Mount Carmel compound near Waco. A gunfight killed four agents and six Branch Davidians. The FBI took over and began a 51-day siege.
Which ended in fire.
April 19, 1993. The FBI attempted to force the group out with tear gas. A fire broke out. 76 people died inside, including Koresh and more than 20 children.
The specificity of Koresh's interpretation made negotiation impossible. He wasn't just a cult leader. He was the Lamb. The seven seals weren't a metaphor. They were a literal script. You can't compromise with someone who believes he's a character in a prophecy that requires a final battle.
And the weapons weren't just for defense. They were part of the theology. The end times would involve a violent confrontation, and the faithful had to be armed. The guns were sacramental.
So we've gone from mountains that store prayer to compounds that stockpile machine guns for the apocalypse. What's the through line?
The specificity of the belief creates a closed system. If you believe a comet is hiding a spaceship, no amount of astronomical data can disprove it. The spaceship is hidden. If you believe a race war is coming, every racial incident is confirmation. If you believe you're the Lamb who opens the seven seals, every challenge is Satan's work.
The narrowness is the defense mechanism. A broad belief has to contend with a broad range of counterarguments. A belief about one specific thing only has to defend that one thing, and you can build a wall around it.
And the wall is made of shared experience. The rituals, the pilgrimages, the fasting, the weapons training. Every time you participate, you're reinforcing the belief. You can't walk away without admitting that all those hours, all that money, all those relationships were built on something false.
Which brings us to the question Daniel was really asking. How do you tell the difference between harmless and dangerous before it's too late?
I think there are a few markers. One, is the belief testable in a way that kills people? The Bertharian's belief is directly lethal if practiced. Two, does the group isolate members from outside contact? The Aetherius Society doesn't stop you from talking to your family. The People's Temple did.
Three, does the leader benefit materially? George King sold books. Fine. Jim Jones took everyone's assets while followers did forced labor. 4. Is dissent permitted? Can you question the central belief and remain in the group? If the answer is no, you're in trouble.
5. Does the belief create a permission structure for violence? Manson's race war, Asahara's world war, Koresh's final battle. When the prophecy includes a violent confrontation, the group will eventually feel compelled to participate.
I've been listening from the desk, and I think you've got the wrong villain. You've spent the whole episode arguing that specificity is the driver. The narrower the belief, the more dangerous the group. But look at your own list. The Aetherius Society has one of the most specific beliefs you described, and they're harmless. The People's Temple had one of the vaguest. Jim Jones was a socialist preacher who gradually claimed to be Jesus and Lenin and Buddha and whatever else, and they killed 900 people.
That's fair, but the People's Temple did have a specific final belief, the conspiracy that the government was coming to destroy them.
Sure, but that conspiracy wasn't the thing that built the group. It was the thing Jones used at the end. The group was built on Jones's charisma and his followers' genuine desire for racial justice. The specificity came later, as a tool. The tool isn't the cause.
You're saying charisma is the real driver, and the weird belief is just set dressing?
I'm saying the belief is the hook, but the leader is the real. Charles Manson didn't need Helter Skelter to be coherent. He needed it to be compelling enough that desperate, lonely young people would believe he had special knowledge. The content barely matters. What matters is that he had an answer, and they didn't.
I don't think the content barely matters. The content shapes what the group does. Heaven's Gate wouldn't have committed mass suicide if their belief had been about charging mountains. The comet gave them a deadline. The spaceship gave them a destination. The specificity dictated the outcome.
But Applewhite and Nettles chose the comet. They could have chosen anything. The belief is downstream of the leader's psychology. If you want to understand why these groups become dangerous, you look at the leader's need for control, not the weirdness of the doctrine.
I think you're both right in a way that doesn't resolve neatly. The leader provides the energy and the control mechanisms, but the specific belief provides the structure. A charismatic leader with a vague philosophy can attract followers, but a charismatic leader with a comet and a deadline can get them to drink poison on a Tuesday.
Unless the vagueness itself is the tool. Jones kept changing the doctrine. Jesus one week, Lenin the next, and that instability made followers more dependent on him. Specificity can actually limit a leader. Once you've said the spaceship is behind Hale Bopp, you have to deliver or explain why not.
Which Applewhite did. He explained that their souls would ascend and the containers would be left behind. The specificity didn't limit him. It gave him the finale.
I suppose where I land is that specificity is neither necessary nor sufficient for danger. It's one variable among many, and you've elevated it to the starring role because it makes for a better episode.
That's possibly fair.
I'll grant that charisma and isolation are the necessary conditions, but I'd still argue that specificity is the accelerant. It turns a slow burn into an explosion. The Order of the Solar Temple had been around for years without violence. Then Dimambro started talking about the transit to Sirius, and within months people were dead.
Or Dimambro was losing control and needed to escalate. The Sirius story was his last move, not his first.
I think what we're circling is that these things are a package. The leader, the belief, the isolation, the rituals, they all reinforce each other. Pull one thread and the whole thing might unravel, or it might reform around a different thread.
The one thing I'll push back on, Hilbert, is the idea that the content barely matters. It matters enormously to the followers. They didn't join because they were hypnotized by charisma. They joined because the belief answered a question they were asking. The Raelians attracted scientifically minded people who wanted a creation story compatible with DNA. Heaven's Gate attracted people who felt alien in their own bodies and were drawn to transcending the physical.
The belief isn't random. It's targeted. It's designed to appeal to a specific kind of person with a specific kind of need.
In an age of algorithmic echo chambers, that targeting is getting more precise. You don't need a charismatic leader in a robe anymore. You just need a YouTube channel and a Discord server.
That's the open question. Are we more or less susceptible to these specific beliefs now than we were in the 1970s?
I'd argue more. The internet lets you find your exact niche. Whatever incredibly specific thing you believe, there are 50 other people who believe it too, and they're all in a group chat reinforcing it. You don't have to go to a mountain. You just have to scroll.
AI is going to make this weirder. Imagine a language model fine-tuned on a specific prophecy. It generates new revelations every day, perfectly tailored to each follower's doubts and desires. It never sleeps, it never contradicts itself, it never gets caught buying snacks at 7-Eleven.
The breatharian chatbot that tells you you're doing great, and the headaches are just toxins leaving your body.
The specificity gets supercharged by the technology. Every follower gets their own personalized apocalypse.
That's a cheerful place to leave it.
The show was produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've got a weird prompt of your own, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. Try not to join any cults in the meantime.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.